Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
So how'd you find out that he was missing?
He was at my house. Last time he was seen was November 8th. The last time I saw him alive was when we hung out on that Friday, November 5th. He came over to my house. We chilled. He was leaving. And I, Curtis Chip, an electronic artist, was performing at the Inferno. We both liked him. So I was like, hey, you know, tonight, let's go to the Curtis Chip show. Like, hey, I gotta go to Milwaukee and meet a friend. All right, cool. Well, give me a call, you know, when you get back. Come on. Close the door, weirdest thing. Like, it just was like suddenly you just know that you have to say something more. Like, you don't know what it is. I guess in a book it'd be me thinking that this is the last time I'm going to see him. At the time, I didn't know what it was, but I closed the door, and then I opened it up, and he's almost around the corner. Dude, make sure you call me when you get back. And he said, oh, yeah. That was the last thing I ever said to him. Make sure you call me
again. Hello, and welcome to episode 50 of The Vanished. Amos Mortier was last seen on November 8th, 2004. You've heard the circumstances leading up to his disappearance, and now you will hear about how the investigation began to shift focus from one friend to the next. Were people acting suspicious because they were involved in the marijuana trade, or was it because they knew what happened to Amos? This is part two of Amos Mortier's story. If you have not listened to part one yet, pause this and go back and start there. This story is extremely complex, so we will start with a short recap of part one.
In the last episode, Amos Mortier was reported missing to Fitchburg police by his mother, Margie, kicking off a week-long search through the muddy fields and swamps around the property he lived on, just south of Madison. The search for Amos Mortier began in earnest on Monday, November 15th, 2 days after his friends, Dirk and Marty, entered the house Amos rented at 5078 Lacey Road. In the kitchen, Dirk and Marty observed a dog dish belonging to Gnosis, Amos's Malamute wolf hybrid. This was noteworthy because the bowl was full of food, and Gnosis was known to greedily eat any food given to him. Upon entering the residence, Dirk and Marty heard an ambient noise accenting the pitch-black interior. As they made their way to the living room, they realized one of his turntables was powered on. The stylus, having played the span of the record, was still striking the inner portion of the still-revolving disc. As the first day of the search came to a close, a woman named Destin Lane called Margie for directions to Amos's house, though Destin would later tell stories that clearly indicated she had been there before. When Destin arrived that night at Amos's house, none of his friends knew who she was. She singled Brent out of the group for a private conversation, raising Dirk and Margie's suspicions that Brent knew more about the situation than he was letting on. Brent had told them before police had gotten involved that a man named Big Jake had stolen $90,000 worth of marijuana from Amos. Destin Lane later told Margie the same exact story.
As the search resumed on Tuesday, November 16th, investigators were beginning to suspect that Amos had fallen victim to foul play, but had only confirmed that he was missing. In addition to his friends finding his house unlocked and Amos's house keys inside of his car, along with his wallet and jacket, police had learned Amos hadn't attended class since November 8th. Shortly after he made his last phone call that day, Amos's cell phone powered down for the last time. His bank account hadn't been accessed, nor had his debit card been used since. Those close to Amos still believed they would find him within the 2 mile search radius around his house, most of it muddy fields and marshland. Many believed Amos had sustained some kind of injury while chasing after his dog Gnosis. As the second day of the search got underway, tensions began to simmer between what Brent described as two different mindsets searchers fell into.
there are people, there were two different groups of people. One group was amazingly, like, optimistic and just, like, keeping the morale up, and we're going to find him. It's going to be all right. And then the other group, kind of like a Tears of a Clown type of thing, you know, like you keep one outward persona, and underneath, you keep another one. In that, you keep the outward persona that you don't do anything to hurt morale, but on the underneath, you don't want to find him.
Though everyone wanted to find Amos alive, many, like Brent, struggled to reconcile that hope with the reality of what searchers were looking for.
Like, when you're on a search like that, especially coming from the standpoint that you don't want him to be dead. You know, I'll speak bluntly. You do not want him to be dead. So when you're out there and you realize that it's 5 days since the last time that it was seen, the human body is the human body. It's not a machine. It's not going to stay alive just because you hope it wants, it will, you know. Like, you don't want, this is swampland and cold-ass marsh and cornfield in November. You don't want him to be out here. He's amazingly optimistic, but amazingly sheltered to think that you're going to come around the corner and a fallen tree that got hit with a lightning bolt is over his ankle, and he's going to be like, thank God you came here, because, damn, and I just can't lift it. There's a point where you just have to. There's either a point where you as a person are gonna be like, any odds can be overcome, and this is a book or a movie, or there's a point where you're just like, there's no way that I want this, you know, come to house we're searching for, you know. And I'm glad it didn't, you know.
Police had allowed Amos's friends to spend the night at his house. But around 10 a.m. that morning, they saw it as a potential crime scene. Police ushered out those still inside, then escorted them back in, one by one, to retrieve their belongings. At 10:30 p.m., detectives would execute the first of several search warrants at Amos's property. As the searchers with belongings inside of Amos's house waited for their escort, something occurred to Margie.
And I didn't want to say this, but did anybody look in Amos's trunk of his car? And he said, no. I said, well, somebody needs to pop open that trunk and look in the car. You know, it's like, I couldn't believe they didn't look in the trunk of the car. That's all. It just seemed like we were having to tell them what to do.
Nothing noteworthy was discovered in the trunk of Amos's Camry, parked in the overflow stall across from the garage. Few were pleased with how the investigation was being managed. These early missteps seemed to come one after another. For 2 days, they had been looking for Amos as well as his dog Gnosis, when one of the searchers began calling around. She learned from the local Humane Society that a dog matching Gnosis's description had in fact been reported found to the Fitchburg police the previous week, on November 9th, the day after Amos went missing.
We told them right away Gnosis was missing and described him. If they'd cross-referenced the missing dog, they would have seen who had Gnosis. They didn't do that.
On November 9th, Amos's neighbor had seen Gnosis running around his property. A short while later, Darcy, who lives four houses down from 5078 Lacey Road, found Gnosis outside of her residence. It took some coaxing, but Darcy, a dog owner herself, eventually got Gnosis inside. Though Gnosis didn't have tags, Darcy could tell someone cared for the animal because Gnosis was so well-groomed. She called the Fitchburg Police Department on the evening of November 9th to report finding the dog so that police could connect her with the owner when they called to report it missing. Upon learning where Gnosis was, Margie and others ran down to Darcy's house. There were several dogs in Darcy's backyard, but none appeared to be Gnosis. As others canvassed that area later in the day, Margie recalls when one of Amos's friends thought he recognized Gnosis among the pack.
I think everybody standing there in that neighbor's backyard, as we, you know, we walked up to the dog fence, you know, and Amos's dog was covered in mud. It's kind of hard to recognize, so we didn't see him right away, but then Dominic called out his name and said Moses. And the ears perked up, came right up to the fence, and we realized it was Moses.
Amos's friends clipped a leash to Gnosis and ran with him back towards Amos's house. Margie vividly recalls the moment she saw the dog.
I can still see Dominic running. Dominic and somebody else went down to the house to get him and had him on a leash, and they're running back, and Gnosis is all hopping around, and like Dominic's, we're all real happy. We're all just, oh, there's Gnosis.
Finding Gnosis in good health gave the search party a much-needed boost in morale. Everyone was excited to have Gnosis back. But the gravity of finding Amos's dog, but not Amos, cut the celebration short.
You know, there's no, but there's not Amos, so we knew that was really weird. We were so happy to find Gnosis, and but it was just, damn, you know, it all hit us, like, this is not good.
The other notable thing that happened that second day was Margie met Destin Lane for the first time. Destin had called Margie the previous evening on November 15th to ask for directions to Amos's house. Destin then arrived at the house where several of Amos's friends had gathered for the night. Dirk recalled that Brent was the only one who appeared to know Destin. She had pulled Brent aside for a private conversation. But Brent told Margie he had also met Destin for the first time that evening. Destin would corroborate this statement in 2007 when she became a target of the federal investigation. But Margie didn't know about Big Jake or the alleged $90,000 worth of marijuana when Destin approached her as the search wound down for the day.
She said she offered to take Gnosis, and I let her take Gnosis that night. When she came back that next day with Gnosis, I handed Gnosis over to Margaret of Hickory Hills Kennel. I didn't want her to have Gnosis. I don't know why. I do feel right about it, you know?
As the likelihood of finding Amos around the Lacey Road area diminished by the hour, the tenor of the search began to change. Brent and others drank heavily once the search had ended each day. Margie went straight to the police after Destin Lane told her about Big Jake. Amos's friend, Keith Burney, recalls that police pressured searchers to return each day.
You know, I wasn't even going to go back after the third day, but no, they say they need everybody, and I'm like, yeah, okay, you know, I went. Amos's sister, his mother, and his uncle were there, and they were searching with us, and it was all strange because they didn't know any of us. As far as they knew, I mean, they could be standing right next to the killer, I suspect, you know, I mean, I just, nobody knew me, for sure, except for Dirk and Brent had met me. And you knew everything was just, bad things were going to happen, whether anything was bad happened to Amos or not. I mean, all these people were somehow kind of caught up in some little something they could get in trouble for.
Keith believes that there was an ulterior motive for why police wanted everyone to come back until the search had officially ended.
Searching was grueling. It was pointless. It was to keep us there so that the police could watch and observe and figure out who of us might be, what can we get out of these people that are showing up to do this.
As the story about Amos allegedly confronting Big Jake percolated outward from Amos's inner circle of friends, questions were raised about his involvement in the marijuana trade. Amos's uncle mentioned to the police that his brother, Amos's father, was serving time in federal prison for manufacturing methamphetamine. Investigators had narcotics on their minds.
They started taking Amos's friends aside and started talking about drugs. Boom, just like that.
They were calling you and telling you about this?
Yeah.
His friends?
Friends.
Yeah. So you were hearing police had kind of shut you out at that point?
Yeah.
So they kind of stopped giving you information like very early on?
And stopped asking me for really anything. Because it did.
The ground search ended on Friday, November 19th, 2004. With suspicions around Destin Lane and Brent Delzer and the extent of their knowledge of or involvement in whatever happened to Amos, questions had also been raised about Amos's friend, Jacob Faulkner. Jacob Faulkner was a well-known marijuana grower who was among Amos's closest friends. Though he lived less than a mile away from the Lacey Road house, Jacob didn't help search for his friend. At the time, there was an arrest warrant with his name on it stemming from a marijuana possession ticket he received roughly 7 years earlier. The warrant was due to expire in just a few weeks.
I got this idea that if I just grew like one or two more crops, I could go get a lawyer and get all my shit, you know, together, which sounds completely asinine when I think about it now. I'm like, and I did go talk to the lawyer, but he told me just wait it out. It's almost gone, you know? And then, of course, I got...
For Jacob, waiting on the warrant wasn't meant to be. On Thursday, November 18th, 2004, detectives arrived at Jacob Faulkner's Laylor Road residence and arrested him on the outstanding warrant. Detective Shannon Shiel Morgan of the Fitchburg Police Department and Detective Dave Bongiovanni of the Dane County Sheriff's Office would head the investigation into Amos's disappearance for the next 2 years. When they returned to the residence to interview Jacob's brother, Detective Bongiovanni observed clippings from marijuana plants on the kitchen table. This led to a search warrant and the subsequent discovery of Jacob's marijuana grow. Official estimates claim that Jacob had upwards of 400 marijuana plants, including plant clippings. Brent says one of the detectives began to fixate on him and Jacob Faulkner. Nothing they could say would convince them otherwise. He said that investigators refused to believe what they said they did or did not know. They assumed those closest to Amos had encyclopedic knowledge of his alleged marijuana dealings.
You can't explain that to people. Like, once they get their head around shit, that's what they think. Yeah, I'll admit. Yeah, when the search ended, it's the bottle. Not just a couple of beers. Like, you fucking drink. Drink to get it out of your fucking head. Just drink. So yeah, you wake up in the morning, you're a little off kilter. Might throw up.
During the search of Jacob Faulkner's residence, detectives not only uncovered a large marijuana grow, but in the bed of Jacob's pickup truck, they discovered a shovel, rope, and tarp they claimed was cut into pieces that resembled the shape of a human body. They also discovered blood in the U-trap of his bathroom sink. Jacob, however, adamantly denied knowing anything about Amos's disappearance or having any kind of business relationship with him. Given what detectives were hearing, they believed this was highly unlikely.
He didn't let a lot of people in, and even the people they did, you know, he kept quite a few secrets from. This whole investigation into him brought forward things about him that I never even knew. You know, some things that I don't even believe, but... What?
Like what?
Just the whole details into, you know, how, what the cops think happened to him. You know, they think he was involved in some huge drug dealing operation. And although, you know, he probably was involved with drug dealing, you know, most certainly was at some time. You know, what he was telling me, especially in the last couple of years before he disappeared, was, you know, he pretty much quit all drugs except for marijuana and went back to school. You know, he'd been in a totally different phase in his life, you know, and for them to come out and say it was like the complete opposite was just hard for me to believe, you know. You know, he could have been playing a ruse to me, but really I was his closest friend, or I'd probably spent the most time with him out of all his friends. He may have, I think he probably was keeping some secrets from me. I mean, I did definitely detect some type of secrecy. But, you know, I was just kind of the type of person he was. You know, he didn't want everybody in his business, and he just wanted to, I don't know. It's hard to explain, really, but he was two people, really. He was mostly the shy person to everybody, and then as soon as he was comfortable with you, he was much more outgoing.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished.
As the investigation entered its second week, detectives began a second round of questioning, beginning with those who had showed up to help search for Amos. Marty and Dirk were forthcoming with their suspicions about Brent. Detectives also discovered Brent and Jacob had been texting each other throughout the search. Most of these texts were Jacob asking for updates. On Brent's birthday, which was December 2nd, 2004, detectives arrived at his house and accused him of being involved in the disappearance. They questioned him about what others believed was his odd behavior, including excessive drinking following each day of the search and vomiting while searching. Detectives were also alarmed by the information that Brent had removed items from Amos's house the night before he was reported missing. Most of the items that he had taken were there in his apartment, but for some reason, he had taken Amos's safe to an ex-girlfriend's house for safekeeping.
That was the first time that I met Morgan and Bon Giovanni.
When did you realize things were sort of taking a turn for the worse?
Well, along about the meeting of the gruesome twosome. Well, man, like that was pretty much it. Like suddenly they show up at my house and start spouting out a bunch of shit. And that pretty much was the defining moment of the change. Like when the door rings.
Your photo table?
Yeah. I'm not gonna say that I freak out and I start running around the house like a basket case, but when the door rings, I resign myself to like this is the time I'm going away. That's just how it is, and nothing.
As Brent and Jacob fell under intense scrutiny by the police, Detective Shannon Shale Morgan called Destin Lane to get a statement from her about the story she had told Margie. Nathan will read that report for you verbatim.
This is the report from Shannon Shale Morgan's phone conversation with Destin Lane, which occurred on Sunday, November 21st, 2004, 5 days after Margie told police about the story Destin had told people at the search about a guy named Big Jake stealing $90,000 or owing $90,000 to Amos. The report goes, Destin stated she has known Amos for approximately 3 years and stated she considers herself Amos's friend and mentor. She stated they are both involved in sustainable energy programs and community food resources. She states Amos is like a little brother to her. Destin stated she called Amos on either October 30th or 31st. She stated he sounded very depressed. She asked him if he wanted to meet for lunch, and he agreed. Destin did not know what day the phone call and lunch occurred. However, she stated it was the weekend of Halloween, that being Saturday the 30th or Sunday the 31st of October. Destin stated that Amos told her he was very concerned about money. Destin stated that Amos is not known to be depressed. However, he was very depressed at this time. She stated that Amos told her that Jake Stadfeld owed him a lot of money, and he wanted to confront him. Destin stated that Amos appeared to be in a desperate state of mind over the money. Destin stated that she believed there is a possibility that the money transaction between Jake and Amos could involve drugs. She stated that Amos did not talk to her about that. Destin stated she told Amos not to confront Jake, and that if there was a concern about him stealing money from Amos, that he needed to go to police. Amos told Destin that he did not want to do that, and he would think about confronting Jake about the money. I asked Destin how she knew Jake. Destin stated she used to be in the music marketing business, and Jake Stadfeld has a production company called Mr. Mean Kitty Productions. Destin stated she has not seen Jake in a very long time. She described him as being very big, fat, and tall, and that he used to work at the Den door as a clerk, selling music. Destin stated she is very concerned, as it is huge for Amos to say anything to Destin about his personal financial life. She was very concerned, as he is very excited about school, and this is the best time of his life. She stated that he was very depressed about the money, and she is extremely concerned.
Destin Lane's statement to Detective Morgan broke the case wide open. Jake Stadfeld was a local musician and concert promoter who Amos had met in the late 1990s. Jake Stadfeld was Amos's boss when they worked together at a State Street convenience store called The Den.
He worked at The Den for me for 2 years, which was, well, maybe not a full 2 years, but he worked up at Shakti after he left The Den and came down to The Den every day he worked at Shakti. I mean, he had a riot at The Den. Everybody did. Everybody that worked there. We were a close-knit family there. And then after that, he worked at Shakti, and then he helped me wire my entire recording studio. He helped me do all the electrical with one of his friends, I think her name was Pam, I'm not sure. And they wired my whole recording studio. They even helped wire my whole fucking recording studio for a very discounted price. There's one person that I ever knew that could leave and go off the grid and never talk to a human person again. It would be Amos.
Stadfeld sees himself as a hustler and the marijuana trade as a game. He says getting ripped off is more or less an occupational hazard, that it happens to anyone, including himself.
Part of the game is if you research this, everybody gets ripped off a bit once in a while. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I told him that I had been ripped off out of a storage facility before. I had been ripped off out of my house before, which I actually, I got ripped off out of my house at 639 East Johnson around like 1998, 99. I had gotten ripped off out of a storage unit before, and I told him. I told Bon Giovanni, because he started getting all huffy with me. I said, "Hey, man, I've been ripped off a few times. What are we talking about here? Why don't you just clarify, what's going on here?" And that's all there is to it. When everybody's lying, Nathan, it's hard to see what's going on. But everybody automatically trusts the police when they lie.
To this day, Big Jake Stadfeld denies stealing $90,000 worth of marijuana from Amos, but says he told the police that getting robbed is what he refers to as the game and is par for the course. The story slowly emerged that after receiving a load of marijuana, Amos became spooked for some reason, possibly due to the arrest of another Madison man who, like Amos, belonged to a local group of marijuana growers and sellers. Amos asked Big Jake Stadfeld if he would stash 30 pounds of marijuana at his recording studio, which had alarms and was under camera surveillance. Stadfeld agreed to do this, but he took the marijuana instead to the residence of a friend, who wasn't connected to Amos, and stored the stash there instead.
I knew that Stadfeld was the dealer, of course, and that's where I used to get my weed from.
That friend, Fred Schubert, explained how shortly after he moved into a condo on Madison's south side, Stadfeld made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
Shortly after I was living there, Stadfeld approached me, and he asked me if I could do him a favor. And the favor was that he was going to leave his stash at my place. And believing this took over me because, Stadfeld said that, of course, I had the convenience of pot anytime I wanted it. And, Stadfeld said he would help me out here and there with whatnot. So for that month, in that month of November, he had a significant amount at my house.
How big was the stash?
Well, honestly, it was a huge stash. And I know that it was probably the $90,000 that was missing. I can tell you that much. I don't know exactly how much it was. And honestly, I was pretty freaked out during the time, and I was also messed up on drugs myself. Back then is when I was kind of at my peak of partying and drinking, playing shows, and doing whatnot.
During Fred's heyday of partying and doing drugs, he was also a living caretaker who went out of town every weekend for work, a fact that Stadfeld was aware of. Needless to say, Fred arrived home from work one day and the marijuana was missing.
And I came home very late. I got home at about midnight, and when I went into my apartment, somebody had ransacked it. And my door in the back, I live in a locked condo, so I unlocked the front door. And the back door, which is a sliding glass door, is open. And the cabinets in my place were all open. And I almost had a borderline heart attack, to be honest with you. So the first thing I did was rush upstairs. And when I rushed upstairs and looked, I saw that they took the whole stash.
Fred found Stadfeld's response to the theft even more unnerving than he had expected it to be.
I told him that you, in other words, just get your ass over here. He kind of acted like I was joking. I will say that Stadfeld is a bad, bad man. And because he uses people for his business, and he's, I know he was extremely arrogant, and honestly, he chose me, I believe, because I have a clean record. If you look up my police record, I've got, you know, like a speeding ticket. And he appeared to be rather calm about everything, which really surprised me. And I don't know if it's his Sopranos maneuver, you know, he's just good at doing stuff like that, or if he had something to do with it or whatnot. Shortly after that, I told him that I was going to be calling the police because what I wanted to do was not, of course, report that a significant amount of marijuana was missing from my apartment. I was hoping that they could get some fingerprints. So I called the cop over, and he dusted for prints. He dusted on the back door. He knew in his mind that either somebody had taken money or drugs from the place.
Detectives quickly learned that in addition to allegedly stealing $90,000 worth of marijuana from Amos, that calls from Jake Stadfeld's landline were placed to an area gun shop on November 4th and November 6th. The November 4th call was of particular interest to detectives since it was the day that Brent had allegedly overheard Amos yelling at Jake Stadfeld during a phone conversation between the two. But that wasn't all. Detectives also learned that Jake Stadfeld's cell phone pinged the Blaney Road cell tower at 3:31 p.m. on November 8, 2004, around the same time that Amos' cell phone powered down for the last time. The Blaney Road cell tower is the cell tower closest to Amos' Lacey Road house. The following day, November 9th, Jake Stadfeld's cell phone again pinged the Blaney Road cell tower at 10:05 a.m. Shortly thereafter, Stadfeld's cell phone pinged cell towers along westbound Interstate 94. Around 11:30 a.m., the cell phone analysis showed that Stadfeld exited the interstate and entered the town of Portage, Wisconsin, before returning to the interstate and driving to his mother's house in Malston, about 90 minutes north of Madison. Even though $90,000 sounds like a lot of money, it may not have been so much for Amos. Jacob Faulkner provides a little insight into the risks involved in moving large quantities of illicit substances.
Part of the reason that I was no longer involved with Amos and drug dealing and why I was kind of like in the dark when all this, you know, supposedly happened, was because when I was 18, I was selling a little bit of marijuana, not for Amos, but, you know, I get weed from a lot of different people, but Amos was one of them. And I ended up getting robbed for 2 pounds of kind bud, which at that point was, you know, almost $10,000.
Yeah,
it was a little less than $10,000. And, it was all fronted to me, so, you know, I was in the hole that much, and I think I was actually already in debt, you know, maybe $300 or $400 to begin with. So it was roughly $10,000, and in angst to pay him back,
Oh, that was Amos' weed that you got robbed of?
Yeah. And obviously I wasn't going to go to Amos and be like, I mean, I told him what happened. He knew I got robbed.
What year is this?
This was in 98.
98.
Could have actually been 99, too.
It was a few years after you met him.
Yeah, this is like a year and a half, maybe. You know, obviously, I wanted to pay him back, so I went to another associate and fronted a bunch of low-quality Mexican weed off him because I knew somebody who could sell it all very quickly. I didn't like dealing with this person because he was kind of a shady character. It just wasn't person I'd normally hang out with on a regular basis, but I grew up with this guy, so I knew it was a trustworthy situation. I thought so. It was quite a lot of, it was probably like 15 pounds or 12 pounds or something, which way, you know, had about $600 a pound or $700 a pound, you know, it's not going to be huge profit or anything, but it was a step in the right direction to paying this back,
And I went and brought a little sample to this kid, and he was like, yeah, I mean, good price and good for the
swag.
Yeah, that's right. Good for that. He told me, yeah, I'll come by in the next couple of days. And I foolishly went out to the bar. I wasn't even 21 yet, but I went out and I came back. And my air conditioner was pushed in.
You got around twice?
Twice in 2 months, yeah. Okay. Fucking crazy. Yeah, it was insane. So now, you know, I'm out like $18,000. I dabbled in growing weed a little bit, and I just was like, you know, I got friends that'll buy Kind Bud and Ace, and I can make a maximum amount of money off of, you know, $50 an eighth or whatever, and I don't have to worry about being robbed, you know. And so I started, I went out and I collected some debts that people owed me, and I think I got like, I don't know, $1,300 or something like that. And I went out and I bought 2,000 watt high pressure sodium lights. And I went to this kid that I'd actually got the swag from and was like, hey, look, the only way you're getting your money is if I grow some weed in your basement here. And I paid his electric bill and I grew the crop, which was not terrible. It wasn't the best weed I ever grew, but it definitely was good. And I paid back most of what I owed the guy. I think it was probably about $6,000 worth of weed, you know, not as much as it should have been, but definitely was starting to pay him back. And then I moved and I started doing some outdoor the next spring, and I did enough to pay back everybody. So I'm like free and clear.
Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere. While traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner. And it's great for my evening walks, too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
For the next year, Detectives Morgan and Bongiovanni traveled all over the country tracking down leads that mostly went nowhere. I say mostly because one of the people they hadn't identified yet was who Amos was getting his marijuana from. During this time, Jacob Faulkner pleaded guilty to manufacturing marijuana and was given 5 years of probation. Nearly a year later, when the investigation went federal, Jacob Faulkner was indicted for the same crime in federal court and given a 1-year prison sentence. Convinced Faulkner was involved in the disappearance, perhaps as an accessory after the fact, detectives were waiting for him when he got out of prison.
They wanted me to come down and talk to him, and I said, well, you know, I really don't want to do that right now. I don't have any reason. I've already told you guys already have like 5 or 6 copies of every statement that I've ever made. I mean, there's no reason for me. It's not like the story's going to change, you know. It's been the same the whole fucking time. What do you want, you know? And so, you know, I pretty much kind of blew them off. Then I came down to live with my brother, and they actually came to try to talk my brother into going and talking to Dan Graver before he was subpoenaed. But I actually was the only one home, and opened the door, and I had a short conversation with Jerry Becca, probably longer than short, probably 15, 20 minute conversation, but, you know, I pretty much told him, I was like, you know, your investigation, or at least the prior investigation, was completely botched. You guys effed up, you know, you dropped the ball on looking for Amos, and you know it. You went off in all these different tangents, which you know led to nothing, or you know, just led to more questions, and some of it didn't even make sense. And he was like, well, now the feds are taking this over, and they're, you know, they're going through this. And he actually, the one thing I have to say about Jerry Becca is he actually asked some very legitimate questions, some things I was trying to tell the Shanisha Morgan and Bon Giovanni when they first came out. Did you ever see anybody suspected Amos was getting marijuana from, or his dealer? And I said, well, you know, if you know anything about drug dealing, which you probably do, you're a 30-year vet of, you know, the Dane County Drug Task Force, you don't exactly advertise who your drug dealer is, because that'd just be stupid. People could go over the top of your head and get a better deal, or you know, it causes risk. You know, they could get robbed or something. So, you know, anybody who's even the lowest, you know, street dealer knows that.
When Nathan began researching the case for his book in October 2007, he contacted Detective Shannon Shiel Morgan to ask about the case, but also as a professional courtesy to let her know about his plans for the project.
What have been some of the delays in the case that's taken so long to...
People not telling the truth.
Yeah, is that the bottom line?
That's the bottom line. Well, I worked on it solidly for 2 years, along with Detective Dave Bon Giovanni. The most frustrating part is people lying and holding back information that can assist me.
Now, is there... Some people seem to think that Amos may still be alive and wanted for questioning in a larger drug probe, and that he caught wind of something and went underground. I'm wondering, is he officially a homicide victim, or is there any chance that...
I would love to have him walk through the door. Of course, because we don't have a body, we can't officially say it's a homicide, but he hasn't been seen or heard from in 3 years.
Now, have the numerous theories that people have subscribed to or thrown out there, has that complicated the case?
We look into everything that is given to us. So, complicated? No. But everything that's been thrown out to us, we've investigated.
Has the case shifted toward more drug investigations and less on finding Amos at this point?
I don't know if that's the shift. Our whole goal is to find Amos. That's the whole goal.
Mm.
Or to find out what happened to him.
Mm. I don't know if this is true or not, but there seems to be an unusual level of secrecy surrounding this case. And I'm wondering...
Secrecy?
Yeah, just with the you know, John Doe probe and the federal grand jury, it seems everything's pretty... Yeah. Pretty quiet mom and difficult to get information on. So I'm wondering if there's a strategic reason behind that, or do you guys have a suspect that you're looking at?
I really can't answer that.
Would you say you're confident that we'll eventually learn what happened to Amos?
I that's my goal. That's been my goal for the last 3 years. I've lived and breathed this case. That's what I
want to
do. I want to find him.
Is it fair to assume, because it's unusual for the federal government to involve itself in a one might assume is a local homicide case, has his disappearance been a segue into a broader drug investigation?
I can't answer that either.
All right. I think that's about all my questions. Unless there's anything you'd like to add.
You know, I just hope that you... I mean, I don't know what kind of article you're writing. I know that there's been a lot of negativity towards the police. But bottom line is, all we've been trying to do is find him.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Bye.
If you've read about the case online, you may notice that there are large gaps between the publication of stories relating to the case over the last 12 years. For example, there are quite a few stories from late 2004 and then in 2005. But only a couple each year after that. I asked Nathan about this.
So the gaps in the media coverage of this case was really a consequence of the secrecy rules around both the John Doe investigation and later on the grand jury investigation, prohibited investigators and witnesses from speaking publicly about the case. With the John Doe, those secrecy rules are more or less a gag order. They prevent witnesses from speaking to media, from speaking to even other witnesses about testimony they were given, questions they were asked. And I don't believe they're even allowed to have their defense attorney in the room with them while they're giving that testimony, though they are able to pause the proceedings so that a witness can consult with their attorney. So the John Doe was initiated in December of 2004, ran, I believe, until late spring of 2005. And so even after the John Doe investigation, witnesses and investigators were still bound by those secrecy rules, and which didn't much matter because once the grand jury investigation began, similar rules were more or less in effect. So from a media standpoint, it was really difficult to get information, not only documentation, because prosecutors both at the state level with regard to the John Doe and then the grand jury investigation, prosecutors, they neither confirm nor deny the existence that these investigations are even taking place. If you know the system and how it works, you can sort of ferret out whether or not these things are going on. Of course, people do talk in spite of the rules. You know, we had a good idea of, you know, who was being subpoenaed and who was seen in, you know, the witness rooms. And so, you know, we knew these things were happening, but, you know, getting people to talk on record about something that just by virtue of talking about it could end up with them being charged criminally for violating the court order, that was incredibly difficult. Isthmus newspaper, the paper that I write for, really did the most, I think, in terms of moving this story forward. There was a gentleman named Jason Shepard who did a lot of the early reporting for Isthmus during the John Doe phase of the investigation, and then later on when 18 search warrants were unsealed, he did a story on those. And the legwork he did on the case was, you know, really commendable. It was a really great job at illuminating a lot of the more kind of, you know, mysterious aspects of Amos's disappearance at a time when really there were a lot of rumors going around and people for, you know, a couple of years at least really even questioned whether or not Amos could have been involved with something so large.
We heard about Amos and his disappearance from those who knew him the best. But in 2008, the case took another unexpected turn in that Nathan suddenly becomes part of the story when he arrived home from work one day and found something extraordinary in his mailbox.
In late 2008, I was living in Philadelphia. I arrived home from work one day and there was a CD in the mail that contained close to 3,300 documents relating to Amos's disappearance that had been leaked to me by a source that I'd been working with back in Madison. For me, someone who had spent a lot of time trying to track people down, build rapport with them, speak with them, it was like winning the lottery. I mean, it really was. The file contained grand jury transcripts, police report, I mean, statements given by anyone and everyone connected to the case from the time the investigation began up until they testified before the grand jury. And so it really kind of gave me a bird's eye view, I guess, of how everything kind of played out. I mean, it was kind of how the dots connected and sort of how things looked through investigators' eyes. But as I was going through these documents, and it's a lot of documents, you know, they're not organized in any really useful way for my purposes. And so, and a lot of the people who there was information on, I hadn't heard of yet. So it took some time to sort through everything. But as I kind of waded through all this sort of legal mumbo jumbo, it started to become clear to me that investigators had really kind of gone down the wrong track in their suspicions. I think it's really clear now that they spent a lot of time targeting the wrong people. In the next episode, we'll explain why.
That brings us to the end of part two of Amos Mortier's story. Stay tuned for part three, which we are hoping to release on Monday. This has been an enormous project for us. If you would like to contact me, I am on Facebook. My Twitter handle is @TheVanishPod. I also now have an Instagram account, and you can email me at thevanishpodcast@gmail.com. I keep forgetting to mention this on the show, but if you would like to hear more about my story, I was on episode 20 of a podcast called Podcasters Unplugged. Earlier this week, I was also a guest on a podcast called Insight, so check those two out if you have a chance. If you would like to contribute to the show, you can do so on patreon.com/thevanishpodcast. Thanks to everyone who has already contributed, and check your mailboxes this week. Thanks everyone for listening, and keep your eye out for part three.
So some of the early missteps that they made, I don't think are necessarily, you know, fair to investigators. I think where the real misstep sort of began was when they began to fixate on certain people, and a lot of it based on, you know, assumption. Jacob Statfeld at the time was a great suspect. I think over time, the evidence against him hasn't held up. Brent Delzer were after him the entire time. They believed he knew more than what he was telling, and that may or may not be the case, but federal magistrate Stephen Crocker ruled that when it came to Brent and what he knows or didn't know, he gave investigators the information that they wanted. He may not have phrased it in the exact way that they had hoped he would, but the essence of what they wanted to know, he provided them. And I thought that was a pretty remarkable vindication of what Brent had been saying all along, which was he cooperated with authorities and showed an interest in trying to find his friend. Jacob Faulkner, the way they came after him, I mean, he was by and large the first suspect in the homicide. After it found out Jacob Statfeld and Jacob Faulkner were friends, Jacob Faulkner was sort of moved like a little chess piece to being an accessory after the fact. If we were to pinpoint a precise moment where things just went wrong in every possible way, that would be the moment. That would be the statement. And Destin Lane, for all her proclamations of being a friend and mentor to Amos, I don't think there's anything anywhere at any point to suggest that she ever cared about Amos beyond the fact that Amos made her and her boyfriend a lot of money.
Years. He is a person of interest, potentially could be a suspect.
Lieutenant Todd Stetzer says they're checking Stanfeld's DNA against a few pieces of evidence that may lead to murder charges.
There are some specific items that we're looking at.
According to the search warrant, late in 2003, Mortier gave Stanfeld 30 pounds of marijuana to hide, worth $80,000. It was later stolen, and Mortier blamed Stanfeld. Mortier started demanding his money, and phone records show Stanfeld started calling gun shops and another local dealer, Jacob Faulkner. Investigators say after Mortier disappeared, they searched Faulkner's trunk and found rope, a shovel covered in dirt, and plastic sheeting cut into body-sized pieces. A cadaver dog hit on Mortier's backyard, indicating a body had been there. The warrant also quotes Faulkner as saying, "When you find a body, I'll tell you everything I know." Statfeld's cell phone records also show he was at Mortier's home the day he disappeared and the day after. And the warrant says he doesn't have an alibi for a few hours each day. As to why it took this long to request the DNA, police say it's taken this long for people to come forward with information. A number of dealers connected to Mortier have been dealing with federal drug charges, and most have now been convicted or cleared.
Once they know what's going to happen to them related to the activities they were involved in, they may be more willing to engage in conversation that they previously were not willing to speak about.
Statfeld himself is waiting to hear if he has immunity from federal charges. If not, he'll go to trial next year.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid. We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
In our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.